Nuclear Anniversary. Today, March 11, 2025, marks the 14th anniversary of the start of the Fukushima Triple Meltdown nuclear disaster. But it's still hard to get a clear picture of what is actually going on at the reactor site. The public gets all kinds of optimistic reports about the cleanup of massive amounts of radioactive water and debris from the remains of the three reactors, with Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, the Japanese government, and their political enablers all claiming that things are going so well, it's on schedule, though they keep changing that schedule. They say that everything is A-OK. But is it? There are many inconsistencies and contradictions in the information issuing from so-called official sources that are echoed uncritically by mainstream media. That's why it takes a report by a grassroots nonprofit group, the Japanese Citizens Nuclear Information Center, or CNIC, to provide us with a more accurate, less optimistic picture. And among other exaggerations and outright lies by nuclear interests that they found, they tell us
about 64% of the stored water exceeds the notification concentration due to past equipment malfunction and operational policies.
In other words, the water is not as cleaned of radionuclides as TEPCO is claiming.
That's correct.
Well, when the Japanese Citizens Nuclear Information Center gives you a report like that, and so much more, all of which points to the ongoing difficulties at the site and how official language covers up the worst of the problems, you see once again how the Fukushima nuclear disaster has not gone away and continues to be an epicenter of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, at the 14th anniversary of the start of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, we take a deep dive into what exactly is the current state of the triple meltdown location and how the truth of it varies widely with the official line put out by TEPCO, the Japanese government, and the International Atomic Energy Agency. We will have a report compiled for us by the Japanese Citizens Nuclear Information Center, or CNIC, by Mayu Takakawa and her team, and presented for us by longtime anti-nuclear activist Tsukuru Fors. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Alistair Burnett from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, with our monthly update direct from their headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, and more honest nuclear information than is still managing to find its way into mainstream media despite this being Fukushima's 14th anniversary. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 11, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. As we start out, I want you to know that I am just back from the week of meetings at the United Nations on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the third meeting of states' parties. The member states of the treaty met at the United Nations in New York to assert that true global security lies in eliminating nuclear weapons, not the doctrine of nuclear deterrence. This is a huge shift forward. It is the strongest condemnation of deterrence ever heard from a multinational forum. The political statement issued at the end of the meeting states, "Nuclear deterrence is posited on the very existence of nuclear risk, which threatens the survival of all." 73 nations have already ratified the treaty. 94 countries have signed and are in the ratification process, and many others sent representatives to observe. My full report on the meeting, as well as my interactions with some of the 350 mostly young campaigners from around the world, will be the subject of next week's special show. In other news, continuing with Japan, the mayor of Futaba, which is in Fukushima Prefecture, Mayor Shiro Izawa suggested reusing soil contaminated by the triple meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear power plant for public works projects within his town. Note that the current population of his town is officially zero. Earlier plans to reuse the soil in the Tokyo metropolitan area were met with protests, and even Mayor Izawa acknowledged that it would be tough to soon implement the plan to reduce the huge stockpile of contaminated soil. After the 2011 nuclear accident, topsoil was scraped off in various parts of Fukushima Prefecture to reduce radiation levels. The contaminated soil was placed in green plastic trash bags and stocked in massive piles in surrounding fields before being placed in an interim storage facility that straddles Futaba and Okuma, the other town that co-hosts the nuclear power plant. The total amount of soil could fill 11 Tokyo domes. And a law enacted for the decontamination project stipulates that the soil must be disposed of outside the prefecture by 2045. But there's no place for it to go. Meanwhile, the central government states that they are planning to reuse, quote-unquote, the least contaminated soil with radioactivities at what they call safe levels for road fill and other purposes. But there is no safe level of exposure to radiation. It is cumulative over one's life, it does its damage, and there's no way to get away from it. So this is about spreading the danger around as opposed to doing anything substantive to contain it and make it safe. A task force set up by the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, which is the UN's nuclear power advocacy program, issued a report in December 24 saying that the disposal of radioactive wastewater from the Fukushima Daiichi reactor disaster site to the Pacific Ocean is, quote, in line with international safety standards, end quote. Ever since Tokyo Electric Power Company first proposed dumping wastewater left from the cooling Fukushima's three hot piles of melted reactor fuel into the Pacific, the IAEA has supported, encouraged, and endorsed the plan in spite of its own formal published guidelines which advise against it. Even before this latest report, in June 2023, Dr. Arjun Makajani of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research published a scathing critique of the IAEA's approval, finding the oceanic pollution violates essential provisions of the agency's own general safety guide. But the IAEA has persisted in reporting that the dumping scheme is consistent with its standards and claimed even before the first major release of radioactive water that it would have a, quote, negligible radiological impact to people and the environment. When the IAEA says that Japan's ocean dumping is, quote, in line with international safety standards, end quote, this is globalized radioactive polluting that is being referenced and endorsed. Or, as an oceanographer friend once pointed out to me, there is no such thing as seven oceans. There is one ocean with seven basins. And what happens in one happens to all. It just takes time. Thanks, Japan! As for the human side of what has happened to the people of northeastern Japan since the March 11, 2011 disaster began, we've posted links to two articles on the website. The first is called Difficult to Return Zones, and is written by Ruiko Muto, a Fukushima native and longtime opponent of nuclear power who has spent more than 30 years in the anti-nuclear movement. And we're also linking to another article, Life as a Displaced Person. It's written by Akiko Morimatsu. After the great earthquake and nuclear disaster in Fukushima, she moved from Fukushima to Osaka with her two children, aged 5 months and 3 years. She is the co-chair of the National Coordination of the Plaintiffs Groups of the lawsuits filed by victims of the Fukushima nuclear disaster and the representative of the plaintiffs group in the Osaka metropolitan area. In this article, she writes, "Even after 14 years, many people continue to remain displaced. The number of evacuees registered with the government is still approximately 29,000 people in all 47 prefectures of Japan. However, the exact number of evacuees has never been counted by the Japanese government. In fact, many more people than registered in official statistics have been compelled to flee their homes and are still in distress with no relief in sight, as they are not officially recognized as evacuees." Again, both these articles will be linked on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 715. Over to the U.S. and its former allies, President Trump has taken aim at Canada with double tariffs on metals. That'll learn them. The only problem for the nukesters is that the U.S. is reliant on Russia for nuclear fuel exports and has no definite plans to replace these imports, the primary one being enriched uranium and, guess what, enriched uranium required for nuclear reactors is a metal. And even that corner, which we have needlessly painted ourselves into, doesn't qualify for the following dual report.
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
There are two examples of numbnuts this week that are so egregious that I didn't really want to have to choose between them, though one of them currently has the lead, but they're both so bad, I wanted to give you both. In the number two position comes a report from MSN.com on their trip ideas on the travel site to the most beautiful abandoned places in the world. And what's number one on their list? Pripyat, Ukraine, the ghost city of Chernobyl. And in their brief PR-like promotion of this as a site, they write, "Pripyat is perhaps the most infamous abandoned city, known worldwide due to the catastrophic Chernobyl disaster in 1986. This once bustling city, home to over 49,000 residents, was evacuated in just a few days following the nuclear accident. Today, Pripyat stands as a haunting testament to the disaster, with its decaying buildings and nature slowly reclaiming the streets. The Ferris wheel in the abandoned amusement park, never used, has become a poignant symbol of the city's sudden desertion. Now get this. Visitors can wander through the eerie remains of Soviet-era architecture, exploring schools, hospitals, and homes frozen in time, offering a chilling yet fascinating experience." And what's missing from this description? The R word, radiation, as in, this is in the middle of the exclusion zone. This is where you're not supposed to go. This is where you can inhale radiation from the dust, get it on your clothes, get it on your hands, wipe your eyes, rub it on your nose. Not one word about the dangers left behind by this 1986 nuclear disaster. It's just beautiful and abandoned. Well, that might mean something different to the 49,000 residents who were forced to leave virtually overnight. Talk about doom vacationing. But even that can't hold a nuclear-powered candle to the actions of Donald Trump, currently President of the United States, in banning certain words that he doesn't like, that he thinks refers directly to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, all things that are anathema to the white, straight males in government who don't want to give up their privilege even an itsy-bitsy teeny-weeny bit. In banning nearly 200 words, a level of censorship far beyond anything we have yet faced here in the United States, and a harbinger of much worse to come, one of those poor, rejected little words was gay, which led to censorship of the name of the plane that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. The name of that plane? Enola Gay, which was the name of the mother of Paul Tibbetts, the pilot of the plane. So what? In history, is it going to be known as the Enola heterosexual, the Enola straight, just the Enola? And retroactively, is her name going to have to be changed because it's got one of those words in it you're not supposed to say? This new set of actions on behalf of, unfortunately, my federal government is both ridiculous and dangerous. Because when they start getting out to what words you can and cannot say, even if one does have the illusion of free speech, self-censorship, and deeply ingrained fear can take away the message that some people who don't agree with the party line want to get out into the world. And that's why, this week, not only MSN for their travel advisory to Pripyat, but to the current President of the United States and his unanointed stand-in, Elon Musk, and whoever else had a hand in setting this insanity up as policy in the United States. You are all this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
In Michigan, Holtec International has signed an agreement with Hyundai Engineering and Construction to build two small modular nuclear reactors at the Palisades Nuclear Plant in Michigan. The agreement aims to deploy a fleet of 10 gigawatt SMNRs, starting with two units at the Palisades site. But what's wrong with this picture? Holtec's design for the reactor has not been licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So not only has a new design been tested, not only has it not been built, there's not even an approved design. This is what's called a PowerPoint reactor. Lots of good graphics, lots of slick talk, honed through many, many focus groups, but nothing of substance except the amount of money that's going to be spent. And we all know that a major portion of that is going to come out of taxpayer pockets. And why the sudden push to get these non-existent little nuclear reactors up and going? That's covered in a story we will link to, Big Tech's Big Bet on Nuclear Power to Fuel Artificial Intelligence, and all those data centers they're going to be needing. Again, all the details on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. The episode is number 715. Over to Ukraine, where 2 weeks after it was hit by a Russian drone on February 14th, Ukrainian firefighters are still trying to extinguish smoldering fires within the large structure built over the reactor destroyed in the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear accident. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, no sign of radiation leakage has yet been detected inside or outside the facility. But there is still an area of 15 square meters, or 18 square yards, of damage from the drone, with further damage in areas up to 200 square meters, or 161 square yards. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi said, "It was clearly a serious incident in terms of nuclear safety, even though it could have been much worse. As I have stated repeatedly during this devastating war, attacking a nuclear facility must never happen." Except it has. Repeatedly. More than 400 emergency response personnel continue to participate in the site's efforts to manage the aftermath of the drone strike. In Poland, that country's Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, said his country must drastically increase the size of its military and even, quote, reach for opportunities related to nuclear weapons. Tusk did not explicitly propose developing a nuclear arsenal, but said that, quote, It is time for us to look boldly at our possibilities of having the most modern weapons and explore options for nuclear and modern unconventional weapons. He added that the Polish government was talking seriously with France, Europe's only nuclear power aside from Britain and Russia, about the possibility of extending the French nuclear umbrella to other European countries. Now here with another perspective on international nuclear issues and the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is Alistair Burnett with the ICANN update.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett from ICANN in Geneva with our roundup of news from the campaign for February. This month, ICANN, along with its partner PAX, the Dutch peace organisation, released the latest Don't Bank on the Bomb report that monitors investments in companies producing nuclear weapons. This year's report showed another fall in the number of financial institutions investing in the 24 main producers. We'll have more on why and how that's happening in a moment. The ICANN team has been busy this month preparing for the third meeting of the members of the TPNW, the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, that takes place in early March in New York. We're expecting to see progress on support for the survivors of the use and testing of nuclear weapons, as well as the clean-up of contaminated areas left over from the 2,000 nuclear tests carried out since the first one, known as Trinity, in New Mexico 80 years ago. We also expect a strong political declaration calling out nuclear deterrence doctrine as a threat to all countries and an obstacle to nuclear disarmament. Now back to the Don't Bank on the Bomb report. One of the co-authors is ICANN's very own program coordinator, Susie Snyder. She told me what they found and how the campaign to divest from nuclear weapons producers is going.
Well, this year's Don't Bank on the Bomb report, which is called At Great Cost, the Companies Building Nuclear Weapons and Their Financiers, was launched just last week. And it shows that 260 financial institutions still have some kind of financial exposure, an investment or a financing relationship with 24 companies identified as the significant contractors producing nuclear weapons. And that's a lot of companies. However, this is still less than there were the year before and in the years before that. There is a consistent downward trend in the number of investors. Nevertheless, it's so much money. It's money that I have a hard time comprehending when we think about how much these investors are still putting into the nuclear weapons industry to try to get a profit. They're investing billions. It's, you know, overall, when you think about both the shareholding of values as well as the credit values, the loan values, we're looking at almost $800 billion associated with the nuclear weapons industry. It's a tremendous figure.
Now, you identified in the report that since the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was adopted, 2017, there's been a consistent downward trend. How do we know that that is partly or wholly due to the TPNW coming into existence?
We know from a few reasons. And one of those reasons is that financial institutions are telling us. They're coming out. We've had more than 130 financial institutions say that they support, actively support the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And they show that support by doing a number of things. They adopt policies that exclude nuclear weapon producers from their investment universe, and they cite the treaty in the policy, or some of them have made public statements saying that they vocally support the treaty and look to apply it to their practices. We even had some financial institutions run advertising campaigns about the nuclear ban treaty because they see the treaty being something of value for themselves and for their clients. It's a useful thing for the world. And I think it is really important to see that, you know, the amount of money may be high, but the number of institutions is on the steady decline. And it is more than 23% less in the number of financial institutions that are engaging and having relationships and profiting from the nuclear weapons industry since before the treaty went into effect. That's a pretty big drop. And I'm happy to see this treaty having such a profound effect across the financial community.
There is some, on the surface, potentially confusing data in the report that, as you were saying, that the number of institutions investing in nuclear weapons producing companies has fallen, but the value of shares and bond holdings has gone up. Can you explain how that happened?
Sure. The way the research is done for the report is to take a snapshot of a certain moment of time and to say, okay, this is how much is out there in the number of shares. This is what their value is. A lot of the companies in the report, the companies that produce nuclear weapons, they've been doing and engaging in some processes like share buybacks that increase the value of those shares. And so that shows the overall amount of money is higher, but it's a projected value. This is an estimate. Shares are not real money, if you will. Shares are an estimate of what one thinks they could get if they were sold at this moment. But the real thing to look at is whether or not the number of institutions overall see this value and share this projected estimate of value. If they think the risk of investing in these companies is worthwhile. And overwhelmingly, they do not. And they're stepping away from these types of investments. When you look at the numbers and you look at the year-on-year comparisons, 260 institutions. And before the ban treaty went into effect, it was almost 340 institutions. And that is what to watch. That's the number that matters here. And that's where we see this positive trend.
And I guess too that the increased share value of these companies is probably a result of the increased demand for conventional weapons because of conflicts in Europe, in Ukraine, and in the Middle East.
The bulk of these companies, General Dynamics, BAE Systems, Leonardo, Lockheed Martin, nuclear weapons is not the only thing that they do. In fact, nuclear weapons is a very small part of their overall contracts. It's still a part of their contracts, but it's not the biggest part. So they're increasing sales of conventional weapons. But again, nuclear weapons tend to be a smaller part of their business, which is why some companies that we've seen over the years have gotten out of the nuclear weapons business completely.
We've seen a pushback in recent years against the ESG policies of investment companies, the environmental social governance issues that they would look at to determine the risk of investing. That pushback has been quite strong and probably will get stronger under the Trump administration. So do you expect the, as it were, the trend, the downward trend in the number of institutions to continue despite that pushback?
You're absolutely right. There is definitely an attack on so-called woke capitalism. This idea that the business sector, that profits should consider the impact of where that profit is derived from. But a lot of the investors who are constrained by this pushback, whether it be state-level legislation or regional legislation in some places, or through other reasons, they have noted that their returns are diminished because an investor wants to look at every piece of information possible in making their investment decision. So we saw an uptick in looking at ESG considerations because it helps give, it's a quick way to talk about doing a thorough assessment of your investment. What is your risk analysis? Will this investment give me a good return? So while we see that pushback, it is having some impact, but the good investor continues to look at all options. And we're still seeing some of those larger investors diminish in the number of nuclear weapon producers that they are exposed to. They're not out of the game completely, but they're inching away. And I do think there's a good possibility for that trend to continue, especially as these companies are just doing bad business.
That was Susie Snyder, and this is Alistair Burnett ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured Voices from Japan interview in just a moment. But first, thank you. You, yes, you, the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat. You're the ones who made it possible for me to attend the United Nations meeting on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, an international in-gathering of the 73 nations that have signed and ratified the ban, which is now international law, along with 94 countries that are in the middle of the ratification process, those that are considering it, and others who just came to take a look and observe the process. Then there was the joy of being in a room with 350 other anti-nuclear campaigners from around the world, all of them dedicated to working to get rid of nukes. I can't wait to tell the story and share the mosaic of voices. I have over 60 interviews to draw upon, and they will be assembled for next week's show. Again, I want to thank those of you who donated to support this trip. And beyond that, I want to thank you for the ongoing donations that make this show possible. I'm aiming to take some digital media trainings and, if possible, hire social media help for the show to help make Nuclear Hot Seat much more visible in the world. That's why I'm asking for donations of any size to help with our outreach. Anything you donate is tax deductible, and it's easy to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send money directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know that whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And that is always, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview, Voices from Japan. Fukushima at 14. On March 11, 2011, a 9.0 earthquake unleashed a massive tsunami that inundated the 6-reactor Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power facility on the northeast coast of Japan. It caused 3 reactors to melt down. There were at least 3 explosions in the first 4 days, and it released massive amounts of radiation into the air, over the land, and into the water. While a cleanup of sorts has been conducted on the site for years, and pro-nuclear forces will always frame the information in a manner that is most positive to them, the question remains, what is the truth of the condition of the site? To find out, I contacted Mayu Takakua, editor of CNIC's newsletter, Nuke Info Tokyo. She and her team provided a report in English, which here is being read by longtime anti-nuclear activist Tsukuru Force. This report is accurate as of February 21st, 2025. It will soon be 14 years since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident began in 2011. To get an update on the state of the reactor and other issues on the site, I contacted Mayu Takakua. She is editor of the English web magazine Nuke Info Tokyo, and she is with the Citizens Nuclear Information Center, or CNIC. She put together a report on the current state of post-accident operations at Fukushima Daiichi, and it is being presented for us today by Tsukuru Force. She's a dedicated anti-nuclear activist and has long been involved in the greater Los Angeles area, as well as on Fukushima issues. Tsukuru, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
Let's start with considering the state of Fukushima Daiichi. How stable is the facility itself?
The water temperature in the contaminated vessels and the spent fuel pools shows no great variation, apart from seasonal temperature changes. The state of release of xenon-135, which has half-life roughly 9 hours and release when uranium fuel undergoes fission, is also unchanged. Therefore, it can be estimated that the state of the reactor is stable. According to TEPCO assessment in December 2024, around 20,000 becquerels per hour of radioactive materials were being released to the atmosphere from the buildings. For comparison, it was 70 million in October 2011.
So around 20,000 becquerels per hour being released into the atmosphere now. What about the state of removal of the spent fuel? What about the state of removal of spent nuclear fuel?
Spent nuclear fuel removal from units 3 and 4 has been completed. Preparations are now being made to remove the spent fuel from units 1 and 2.
What is the state of the contaminated water?
Contaminated water countermeasures at Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Station can be broadly divided into 3 areas. 1, reduction of groundwater flowing into buildings. 2, reduction of contaminated water flowing into the sea, and three, reduction of the toxicity of contaminated water. There are four main countermeasures to reduce water inflow into the buildings from higher elevations downward. Pumping up groundwater bypass and releasing it into the sea. Installation of a frozen earth barrier surrounding Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Station Unit 1 to 4. Pumping up water at the sub-drain and releasing it into the sea, and paving of the site with asphalt to suppress permeation of rainwater into the soil. Measures to prevent the discharge of contaminated water into the ocean include groundwater leakage prevention by steel water barrier on the seaside, pumping up of groundwater dammed up behind the seaside water barrier from the well points and groundwater drains. Due to these measures, the volume of contaminated water discharged fell from 540 cubic meters per day in May 2014, and currently it keeps under 100 cubic meters per day. However, there are many drainages on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station site, and the water flowing into the sea from the drainage contains many radioactive substances. Also, according to TEPCO's estimate, as of 2029, groundwater of 30 tons per day will flow into the ocean beyond seaside water barrier impermeable wall. This groundwater also contains radioactive substances.
So this is radioactive water flowing into the Pacific Ocean over and above the planned and announced releases by TEPCO of the treated water that is still contaminated with tritium. Is that accurate?
Yes. In the reduction of the toxicity of contaminated water, cesium and strontium are removed. Then, after the impurities are removed using a reverse osmosis membrane, advanced liquid processing system, so-called ALPS, is used to remove 62 radionuclides from the water. Then water is stored in tanks. The total amount of 129,000,790 cubic meters of such water is stored as of January 30th, 2025. However, about 64% of the stored water exceeds the notification concentration due to past equipment malfunction and operational policies.
In other words, the water is not as cleaned of radionuclides as TEPCO is claiming.
That's correct. Oceanic release of the ALPS-treated contaminated water began on August 24th, 2023. A total of 78,285 cubic meters being released in 10 batches by January 2025, and one more release is planned in this fiscal year. Roughly 15,720 cubic meters of water remain in buildings. In addition, concentration of tritium in the ALPS-treated water released in the sea has been gradually increasing. As of January 23rd, 2025, the number of storage tanks for ALPS-treated water is from Unit 1 to 4 is 1,083 units. On the 14th of this month, TEPCO began dismantling the emptied tanks, aiming to complete the dismantling of 12 units by March 2026. On the vacant site, approximately 1,600 square meters, they plan to construct a storage facility for debris that will be retrieved from Unit 3.
How are they handling retrieval of fuel debris?
Originally, the retrieval of fuel debris was scheduled to start in 2021. However, it was delayed for 3 years. There had been delays in development of a folding robot arm removal device, as well as there had been various troubles. Because the device didn't meet the expected functionality, the different device was adopted. After experiencing equipment troubles and correcting the mistake in procedure, the removal of the debris from Unit 2 resumed on October 28, 2024. About 7/10 of a gram of debris was collected using a telescopic type removal device. It was sent to Japan Atomic Energy Agency's Owari Nuclear Engineering Institute for non-destructive analysis, and the result was published at the end of January 2025. According to the analysis, the sample seems to contain fuel components. Then the debris sample were sent to four institutes to carry out detailed analysis.
So to recap and put this in context, less than 1 gram of debris has been collected from the ruins of the nuclear reactors. And this is out of how much total debris?
About 880 tons of debris. According to TEPCO, the decommissioning will be completed by 2051 in the decommissioning schedule of nuclear power plant. Demolition of reactors and buildings estimated to take 11 years.
How realistic do you feel that date is for completion of the work?
It doesn't seem realistic. If we use this schedule, it is necessary to complete the removal of debris by 2040. To achieve this, more than 160 kilograms per day of debris have to be removed from now and 2040. In the case of the Three Mile Island nuclear station, average amount of debris collected per day was 85 kilograms. Considering the fact the condition of the Fukushima Daiichi is more severe than the Three Mile Island, it is not realistic. In the case of Fukushima Daiichi, fuel debris is present not only inside of the reactor pressure vessel, but also accumulated at the bottom of the vessels. It'll be very difficult to remove the debris because the bottom of the pressure vessels is missing. It is impossible to shield radiation by filling it with water. Also, the access to debris seems very hard. The main route to access the debris is assumed to be the top opening of the reactor containment vessel. The opening is closed with three layers of shield plugs. It is considered that there's a large amount of radioactive material in between the shield plug layers, and this radioactive material needs to be removed before collecting the debris. According to the report issued by Atomic Energy Society of Japan, even if the removal of the debris would be completed by 2051, as the government planned, it would take another 100 years or more before the site becomes available to use after the process of demolition of the equipment and the buildings and removal of contaminated materials.
This is obviously a massive, unprecedented undertaking. What is the projected cost of decommissioning and handling the low-level radioactive waste?
The estimated decommissioning cost is 8 trillion yen, or over 52 trillion US dollars. But it is the cost up to the point where the debris is removed. When the cost of the disposal of the huge amount of radioactive waste that will be generated is included, it is certain that the cost will be much higher. According to the Atomic Energy Society of Japan's estimate, the amount of low-level radioactive waste generated by the decommissioning is more than 7.8 million tons. In general, the amount of low-level radioactive waste from decommissioning of nuclear power plant is around 10,000 tons. There are no plans where to dispose the waste. If we apply the decommissioning cost of conventional nuclear power plant to this case, the amount is over 22 trillion yen, or $145 trillion.
Yow.
TEPCO has set aside an average of 300 billion yen per year, or just under $2 billion per year, as a reserve fund for decommissioning. It'll take 27 years to accumulate the necessary 8 trillion yen. If 22 trillion yen were added to the reserve amount from this year to 2051, annual reserve amount would be over 800 billion yen. However, TEPCO's annual net profit is around 200 billion yen.
It doesn't sound like TEPCO will have anywhere near enough money to cover the cost of cleaning up this site. If that is so, will the government, meaning Japanese taxpayers, have to take up the slack?
Yes.
The triple meltdown contaminated a large amount of soil and turned it radioactive. What is supposed to happen to store and possibly recycle this contaminated soil?
At the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident, a large amount of radioactive material was released. So-called removed soil, which is topsoil, contaminated by radioactivity, removed and retrieved from gardens and farmland by decontamination work in Fukushima Prefecture, has been stored in the interim storage facility located around the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station. The interim storage facility covers about 4,000 acres. As of December 2024, around 13 million cubic meters of soil is stored. Okay. The amount is expected to be increased in the future. The government promised and specified in the law that the final disposal of the soil will be completed outside Fukushima Prefecture by 2045. However, the location of the final disposal site has not been decided. According to the Nuclear Reactor Regulation Act, only waste of 100 becquerel, According to the Nuclear Reactor Regulation Act, only waste of 100 becquerels per kilogram or less can be recycled. In order to reduce the amount of the soil for final disposal, currently the Ministry of Environment is trying to revise its standard for recycling of removed soil to 8,000 becquerels per kilogram. In preparation for the recycling of removed soil to use in public works all over Japan, then 3/4 of the soil in the facility will meet the 8,000 becquerels per kilogram standard.
That's just playing games with numbers. Won't that action risk spreading radioactive material throughout the country, where it will continue to contaminate the population, the land, the water, and the air?
Yes.
One of the ongoing concerns has been the increase of thyroid cancer rates in Fukushima Prefecture, especially among children. What is currently known about that?
Since the accident, more than 300 children have developed thyroid cancer. According to the data collected for 10 years from 1998 to 2007, in Japan, the general annual incident rate of thyroid cancer for children under 19 years of age is 2.1 per million people. On the other hand, Fukushima Health Management Survey suggests, although the rate varies among the surveys, that the incident rate is about 30 in 100,000 people, which is much higher rate than the general rate. However, neither Japanese government nor Fukushima Prefecture recognized the effects of radioactivity on thyroid cancer.
That one just floors me. Has there been any change in Japan's nuclear power policy since the triple meltdown in 2011?
At the end of last year, the government presented a draft strategic energy plan, which indicates direction of Japan's medium to long-term energy policy. According to the draft, the nuclear power ratio of electric power generation mix in 2040 is 20%. Currently, 13 reactors are in operation in Japan, but in order to achieve 20%, all 36 reactors, including the ones under construction and shutdown, need to be in operation. It is virtually impossible goal.
Has there been any kind of a move to implement genuine renewables, like solar, wind, tidal, and the like?
Regarding nuclear fuel cycle policy, unlike the United States, Japan has a policy of recycling of nuclear fuel by extracting plutonium from spent fuel. However, the construction of the Rokkasho reprocessing plant has not been completed. It has been 32 years since the construction work started in 1993, and the company, Japan Nuclear Fuel Limited, is currently aiming to complete it in 2026. Aside from that, as a result of reprocessing of spent fuel carried out in the old plant as well as in France and UK, Japan possesses about 44.5 tons of plutonium.
At this point, there were some technical problems with the recording. So for the last two questions, I will both ask and answer them based on a script prepared by Mayu Takakua of CNIC. What is CNIC doing to keep awareness of these issues alive and to hold TEPCO accountable? And she replied, Citizens Nuclear Information Center, or CNIC, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to securing a safe, nuclear-free world and independent of the government and industry. CNIC was established in 1975 and will celebrate our 50th anniversary in September this year. We gather information from many sources, including the internet, newspapers and journals, government and industry publications, raw data from accidents and incidents, and scientific reports and papers. We analyze this information to produce an understandable overview of the nuclear industry and the government's policies in Japan. We try to present a balanced view of nuclear power and help local citizens groups and the general public to make informed decisions about nuclear issues. We also actively disseminate policy recommendations and publish the monthly CNIC newsletter, which summarizes the latest information. In order to deliver information on Japan's nuclear issues to overseas, we publish Nuke Info Tokyo, an edited version of the CNIC newsletter, for a global audience on our English website every other month. It is available for free viewing. If people wish to learn more, where can they contact you? And she replied, if you are interested, you can visit our English website at cnic.jp/English. As I mentioned earlier, Nuke Info Tokyo is available to anyone. But if you would like to receive a notification email when we publish Nuke Info Tokyo and release a statement, please send us an email to contact@cnic.jp. Nuclear Hot Seat will, of course, be publishing these links on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 715. In closing, I want to thank Mayu Takakua of CNIC for compiling this extensive report on the state of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster site. Thanks also to Tsukuru Fors for reading it as my guest this week on a special episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, our annual Voices from Japan. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 11, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat via email every week, and who wouldn't? It's a great thing to get. And we make it easy. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, or cut to the chase and do us a favor. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow opt-in box that will pop up right in front of you. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week You will get one email with a link to that week's show and a brief description of the material that's inside of it. As a bonus to me, by signing up through the website, Google pays closer attention to me, and I show up a little bit better on their algorithms, which means that the show will get out to more people. But however you decide, just make sure you get the show every week, because this is the ongoing history of who we are, what we're doing, and what it is taking for us to win. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need and appreciate your support. Anything and everything helps. So please do what you can to support us. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that, as President John F. Kennedy said as a warning during the Cuban Missile Crisis, nuclear deterrence works brilliantly until it stops working. And then none of us will be alive to tell them they were wrong. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.